Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, Larry Mueller here, and I'm glad to be back after a week away. Thanks to Jim Packard and everybody who filled in for me. Jim on every day as he talked with a variety of guests, and I'm looking forward to visiting with our guest of today to begin our program, Kim Nielsen, who is an award-winning historian at the UW-Green Bay. She's the author of a new book out about Helen Keller's amazing teacher, Ann Sullivan Macy. The book is titled Beyond the Miracle Worker, The Remarkable Life of Ann Sullivan Macy and Her Extraordinary Friendship with Helen Keller. And I thought I knew a little about Ann Sullivan Macy, but realized in reading the book that I knew almost nothing about her. And what a remarkable person. And a fascinating story that Kim Nielsen has given us as she did this historical piece on her. If you would like to join in as we visit with Kim, maybe you have some questions about perhaps Helen Keller or perhaps about Ann Sullivan Macy or her life. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Give us a call, shoot us an email, and we'll be happy to get you on. Kim Nielsen joining us by phone today. Kim Nielsen, hi. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Larry. I'm happy to be here.
Really pleased to have you here. And as I said in my introduction, I thought I knew a little about Ann Sullivan Macy, but I realized I knew almost nothing about her until I read your wonderful book.
Well, I'm so glad you liked the book, and I found her incredibly interesting as well.
You wrote a couple of books about Helen Keller, and I think you at one point said that you were kind of sick of writing about Helen Keller, and that you would probably never write anything remotely related to her, as a matter of fact. How did you come about writing about Ann Sullivan Macy?
Yes, this is a book that I did not originally intend to write. I've spent 8-9 years of my life completely immersed in the life of Helen Keller, and I wanted to completely get away from her. Everything, everyone, remotely to her. And then, you know, historians are a little weird. I read the 1916 letters that she had written, the two women had written. I reread them again and again. And I decided to go back to her. There are very few letters that exist between the two women. And I realized that I had shortchanged her. Despite all those years I'd spent on Helen Keller, I'd never really taken Annie seriously. These letters are really amazing. It was a unique moment in their lives, and they drew me back into her.
Yeah. Well, most of us see Ann Sullivan Macy as just the teacher of Helen Keller, but she certainly deserves a lot more credit than that.
She does. She's really a fascinating person, and I think that maybe to go back to those letters, what I liked about them is that this was a point in her time where her marriage had fallen apart. She thought she was dying of tuberculosis.
Yeah.
This was a disease that she had watched her mother die from, and it's a horrible disease to die from at that point in time. And she had sort of skipped out of the hospital treatment and ran away to the fields of Puerto Rico, where she hid. And it was also a time where Helen Keller was in trouble. She had secretly fallen in love. She'd become secretly engaged. And then she'd lied about it. And the two women wrote these amazing letters. And I said, it made me go back to Ann Sullivan Macy. I think she deserves more.
Yeah.
Her teacher, her identity, it was very important to her. And I think she's an important teacher. And I want to give her credit for that. I don't want to take away from that at all.
Well, she had a miserable start to her life.
She did. She really did. Her parents were Irish immigrants, very poor Irish immigrants. Her mother died while Annie was relatively young. Her father apparently drank a lot. Her family could not take them in. Several siblings of hers had died already. And she spent her first years in a Tewksbury almshouse of Massachusetts, which was a really horrid place.
Yeah, you're right about that. And it's just hard to imagine living in under those kinds of conditions. She was with it. It was a home for kind of all ages and all problems. People with all every kind of problem you can imagine.
It was, you know, in the mid 19th century U.S. You know, we as a nation were beginning to realize that we needed to deal with and help people who did not have resources for themselves, but were still experimenting with how to do it. And in Massachusetts at that point in time, and usually throughout the country, it meant the creation of one place, an almshouse or asylum, where anyone who was having difficulty in other places could go. So this meant people of all ages. It often meant people with severe mental difficulties, people with physical disabilities, women who were pregnant and were not married. And when Annie arrived in the almshouse...
With her brother.
With her brother. She was just 10 years old. He was 7 years old. This was a place that was built for 500 people and already had 918.
Yeah.
And she stayed there for approximately 4 or 5 years. And it really was a very difficult place.
Yeah, it was, and she used quite a bit of initiative to get herself out of it.
She did. I think, first of all, it's amazing that she stayed alive while she was there. Her brother died within about 6 months.
Yeah.
And it was a place that, you know, she hints at some violence that went on. She hints at all kinds of possible traumas that went on there. But she did get out of there, and how she got out was that she had heard of a school for blind students. She was blind. She had trachoma, and trachoma was a very difficult disease. It's an infection of the eye and causes scar tissue to develop, and it's almost like sandpaper develops underneath the eyelid. And at that point in time, there was no treatment other than to scrape the eyeball. So she was in a lot of pain. Her sight was variable. But she had heard of a school for blind students, and she wanted to go there. And throughout her life, she always remained incredibly stubborn, and I think this is one more example of it. But she had heard of the school, and she wanted to go there. Perkins was a place, or excuse me, Tewksbury was a place, like all kinds of other almshouses, where dignitaries went and toured at that point in time. And she basically... forced her way into a group of touring dignitaries and begged for an education, or at least the story is that as she tells it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those touring dignitaries was a guy named Franklin Sanborn, who was a friend of Samuel Gridley Howe. And Samuel Gridley Howe was the founder of Perkins School for the Blind, and Franklin Sanborn made sure that she got there. And she entered Perkins School for the Blind in 1880 as a charity student. And the state of Massachusetts supported her there.
Yeah. But
she always talked about Tewksbury as a crime against childhood. It was something that she was very ashamed of. She hints at, and I suspect various traumas went on there. In fact, she didn't even tell Helen Keller about her life there until Macy was in her 60s. It was something she kept completely private to herself.
Well, yeah, the fact that she would, she and her brother would play in the area where the corpses were, the morgue, essentially.
Yes.
Because it was a place where nobody else would go, essentially, to play. And then you have a very touching story about when her brother died and her going into there, sneaking in to see him.
Yeah, she and her brother had to, I think, really throw child temper tantrums, in essence, to stay together when they entered the almshouse. And he was all she had at that point in time. And they did. But what that meant is that they sort of hung out away from other children. There weren't many children there. And as you said, they claimed the morgue. They called it the death house. And made it their playhouse, their private place. Then... when he died several months later, it was a place of trauma for her. She snuck back into it after he died, and his death was very traumatic for her.
Yeah, well, when she her life in Perkins was tough as well, especially in the beginning.
It was. She was he was not a very polished kid.
No, yeah, from the sound
no.
of it.
No. Perkins was a place, it was a very classy place. It was a leading, perhaps internationally leading school for the blind students in the world. And most students could pay their way. Their families could pay their way. And she was a charity student. She was unpolished. She was gruff. She had lots of resentments. She didn't know how to read. So she was in a class with younger students, which embarrassed her tremendously. She didn't have money for clothing, for books. She had more physical pain than many of the other students. And I think she would have been a very difficult student. I often think about her as a teacher. She would have been a very difficult student at Perkins. But she eventually came out and became valedictorian. She made her way through.
She did that. And of course, as was the case with all blind students, at that time they graduated, but then how do they find work?
Yeah, that's a good question. Perkins liked to claim at that point in time that one of their main goals was to provide job training for their students who are blind and make them able to be economically independent. But it really was very difficult. There were certainly discrimination in hiring blind students. Many of the blind students, particularly the women, went back to their families after graduation. You know, but Ann Sullivan had no family to go back to.
Right.
She had no one else to lean on. And, really, the school was a little afraid at one point they were going to have to throw her back out in the street or back into the almshouse because she had no place to go once she was done. And it's a wonderful sort of accident of history that she ended up with Helen Keller.
Yeah, it surely is. And maybe you could just talk about how that happened.
Sure. Helen Keller was 14 years younger than Ann Sullivan Macy, so when Ann Sullivan Macy was graduating from Perkins School for the Blind, Keller was about 8 years old and living in Tuscumbia, Alabama. She had become blind and deaf at 19 months of age, and her parents, particularly her mother, but her parents had sought education for her when many others had told them to, in essence, throw her away. Keller's parents sought education for her, and they ended up writing Alexander Graham Bell, who's a leading educator of deaf students at that point in time. And Bell recommended that they try Perkins. And so Keller's father had written to Perkins explaining that he had a deaf-blind 8-year-old. And the director of Perkins, his name was Michael Anagnos, thought this was a great opportunity, you know. Michael Anagnos was sort of stuck with Ann Sullivan, whom he didn't want to throw out on the streets. And here was a man from Alabama seeking a teacher for his daughter. And so Michael Anagnos suggested Ann Sullivan to be the teacher or governess, as sometimes they use that word, of Helen Keller. They weren't sure whether Keller could be taught anything, but to be a caretaker for Helen Keller. And Ann Sullivan traveled by train down to Tuscumbia, Alabama, knowing that she desperately needed a job. I always find it ironic. Earlier, she talked about teaching as something that she did not want
to do. She hated the idea of it.
Yeah. spending time with all those kids and wiping their noses. She was not interested at all. But she needed a job. She needed a job really badly. And ended up going down to Alabama.
And she really didn't have any, what you would call, formal training as a teacher, did she?
She did not. She had her high school degree from Perkins. In later years, Perkins and Michael Anagnos talked about how Ann Sullivan Macy had studied the teaching of Laura Bridgman, another deaf-blind student from Perkins. She really did not do that much of it. She ended up down there with virtually no pedagogical training was very honest in admitting at first to sort of privately to a friend that she had no idea what she was doing. But she persisted and was able to teach Helen Keller.
Yeah, absolutely. Kim Nielsen is our guest today, award-winning historian and author of Beyond the Miracle Worker, The Remarkable Life of Anne Sullivan Macy and Her Extraordinary Friendship with Helen Keller. Questions for Kim, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, if you want to find out a little bit more about questions about Kim, about Anne Sullivan Macy, or about Helen Keller. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kim Nielsen, our guest today, as she visits with us about her book, Beyond the Miracle Worker, The Remarkable Life of Anne Sullivan Macy and Her Extraordinary Friendship with Helen Keller. Fascinating story, for sure. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. The Kellers were, at least when she first arrived, I think the father had a fairly decent income, although money seemed to be always a problem in their lives.
They did. One of the things I talk about in Beyond the Miracle Worker is how the Keller family, particularly before the Civil War, had been fairly well established and had a good number of slaves. But after the Civil War and by the time Anne Sullivan arrived, it certainly had more money than Anne Sullivan's family ever had, and they had enough to initially hire Anne Sullivan. But money was always an issue for Sullivan and then later Keller as she grew to adulthood. And for the Keller family, they struggled to be able to afford paying Anne Sullivan Macy's salary, and for many years did not pay her salary.
Yeah, she essentially worked for her room and board, you might say.
She did. And, you know, whatever money could be gotten other ways, sometimes by, occasionally, I guess, by making some appearances and speaking. But money was constantly an issue for her and Keller.
Yeah, absolutely. And Annie had to deal with... you mentioned that she was blind or could, she had some limited vision, did she not?
She did. One of the things that, to me, is really fascinating about Anne Sullivan Macy is that she was Helen Keller's teacher. So during her lifetime, and even today, many people assume that she must have been able-bodied because they assume certainly, sort of with ableist attitudes that a teacher must be able-bodied. But Anne Sullivan Macy had fluctuating eyesight her entire life. There are points in her life when she had virtually no eyesight, points in her life where she had fairly good eyesight. It varied tremendously, but was never very good. I always think about her when she arrived in Alabama. She had just had some eye surgery again. She had repeated eye surgeries throughout her life. And she arrived down there with her eyes swollen. She had just had the eye surgery. They were very red. Her feet were swollen because she'd had new shoes and had been foolish enough to wear them to walk around, and was looked to be in very sorry shape. But she had very variable eyesight, and I think really makes us think about what it means to be blind, what it means to have a disability, because it was so variable throughout her life.
Yeah. Well, we have some callers. I want to give them a chance to join in. And we'll go first to AJ, who's traveling through the state. AJ, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you.
Hi, AJ.
Hello. I'm kind of interested in what was Anne Sullivan's role with Helen Keller's kind of later radicalization and fight for the rights of both handicapped and the oppressed people?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that... one of her roles was simply that she really encouraged Keller to do what Keller wanted to and what Keller thought. And she pushed Keller to think about what was possible for her, so she pushed at that. However, apparently the two disagreed about politics quite a bit. Keller, as you hinted at, was very involved in progressive and sometimes radical politics. And Anne Sullivan Macy was skeptical about politics in general. She was skeptical about people with power. She skeptical about bureaucracy, skeptical about government. So apparently the two of them argued about it quite a bit. Annie also had a role in that she helped to bring in John Macy into their lives, who was someone who introduced Keller to radical politics. So that's another role. But they actually disagreed about it, which I think is an interesting aspect of their friendship.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Betty in Waukesha next. Betty, hi to you.
Yes, hi. I'm interested in the concept of a teacher, only a teacher. The concept of teacher is changing the idea that now social life is important to the children, and it's teaching the emotional response to the teacher and the teacher's emotional feeling toward the set. I just wonder if Annie wasn't, for both of them, whether the opportunity to be close, because they were both so isolated, to be close physically and emotionally, whether Annie didn't see the advantage of that and understand it so well because of her own isolation, and this closeness and physical closeness wasn't a wonderful opportunity for both of them.
Mm.
I think you're right in many ways, that one of the reasons Ann Sullivan Macy loved being a teacher and loved working with Helen Keller as a child is that she was incredibly emotionally needy. She had very few people in her life emotionally, and, you know, as you say, just physically, all of us need physical contact. And even, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but when Annie met Helen Keller, Helen Keller was the same age as Annie Sullivan's brother Jimmy when he died, approximately. So I think Helen Keller, especially in those early years, met many needs for Annie, and one of them was to have someone to care for, to have someone to be emotionally tied to have someone whom, you know, she could hug and care for. And that was very important to her. And she always talked about teaching as an emotional process, you know, that teachers needed to care for their students in a very, not only care for their students that they learn to read and write and do mathematics, but they needed to care about students' whole emotional lives.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Well, and that's the sort of the technique that she used originally with Helen Keller was to sort of isolate her away from the family to some extent, and also to be sort of a disciplinarian, which apparently Helen Keller was never disciplined or very little disciplined before Annie Sullivan arrived. And that she used that as a way to teach her.
She did. When Ann Sullivan arrived and started teaching Keller, she originally used the strategy that the little bit she'd been encouraged to do from Perkins was to teach sort of one random word at a time. And she quickly gave up on that. And she says that she watched how other mothers are how mothers related to their children, right? Today, when parents talk to a one-year-old, we don't teach them language by throwing random one word at them, isolated. We converse with children, even if they have no idea what we're saying. We talk to them.
Sure.
With full sentences, phrases. You know. And she began to do that with Helen Keller and felt that, particularly at the beginning, what she needed to do was isolate Keller from her family, that her family had, to use today's language, enabled Keller's, in some ways, obnoxious childhood behaviors, and that for Annie to teach Keller, she needed to isolate her. So she did. The two of them, in essence, lived isolated in a garden house for a couple weeks, and that was one of the original breakthroughs.
And she made rapid progress.
She did. Oh, I always think about how fun that would have been as a teacher.
Oh, man.
Yeah, you know, just... It seems like exponentially, Keller just made incredibly rapid progress. That once she learned, boom, everything clicked into place. You know, and teachers know that magic clicking moment when you can see in students' faces or eyes that they've got it. And once Keller got it, boom, she learned just exponentially quickly.
And she... Ann Sullivan, I should say, had a quite a close relationship with Michael Agnagnos? Is that how it's pronounced?
You know, Agnagnos is
Agnagnos.
How do I do it, but...
And in fact, as Helen gained in reputation, there was an incident that I had never read about or had heard about, which involved a story that Helen wrote, apparently as a gift to Michael.
Yes. You know, Perkins School for the Blind was very famous, as I said, as one of the premier institutions for blind students. And once Keller became famous, Perkins and Michael Agnos was eager to take credit for having sent Anne Sullivan down there and for her teaching methods. And Annie had worked always very closely with and had a very close relationship with the director of the school. So at one point she had Helen send Michael Agnos a story that Helen had written as a young student. And Agnos was very proud of it. He sought to publicize it and publicized it in the school's newspaper. But what people eventually learned is that it very closely chronicled the language of another story. And Keller ended up being charged with plagiarism. And it became a very public event across the country. Keller was approximately 10 years old at this point in time. It's estimated that the story had been read to her perhaps a year and a half earlier. And she had used some of the same language. She had no memory of it, apparently. But the question became, was this Keller's fault? Was this Anne Sullivan's fault? Who was to blame? Who would be discredited? Certainly for people from Perkins who were very angry, they were eager to discredit Anne Sullivan and not themselves.
And there was a bit of a struggle, it seemed, for Helen Keller between Anne Sullivan and maybe Perkins and some others as well, Alexander Graham Bell.
There was, several times, actually, throughout Keller's life before adulthood. And once she became famous, everyone was eager to take credit and to take charge of her schooling, and whether that would be her parents or people from Perkins School for the Blind, or at one point there was a teacher from a preparatory school in Cambridge, the Cambridge School for Young Ladies. Others were very eager to take control of this education and of this amazing student. It's when you look at it, who should have won, the directors of these famous schools or this, very young woman in her 20s who came from nowhere and who had little education herself? But each time Anne Sullivan Macy won out and remained, in essence, in charge of Helen Keller's education.
And part of that had to do with Mr. Keller,
yes,
who relied totally on Anne Sullivan.
He did. When push came to shove, he trusted her. Kate Keller, Helen Keller's mother, did as well. And they also turned to Keller, who was rapidly growing up. And whenever Keller had the chance, she signified that she would like to remain with Anne Sullivan. And so the parents, when push came to shove, would back and support Anne Sullivan.
Here's a question, an email question, which we touched on a bit, but Gary in Milwaukee says not much is widely known about Helen's politics, membership in the Industrial Workers of the World, which is the most radical union in U.S. history, and a member of the Socialist Party. How did Anne Sullivan Macy's politics influence Keller's politics? You talked a little bit about that. But then, parenthetically, he mentions Keller appears on the Alabama State Quarter. Did the state of Alabama know of Keller's politics? And if so, why would a right-to-work state select Keller for their quarter?
Keller, actually, this is how I originally got into Keller. I started life working on women in politics as a historian. And, today we look back on Helen Keller, in essence, in very bland, sweet ways. Keller was an intensely political person, and Keller loved politics and cared about politics. And, as many of your listeners know, she was involved, like many Americans, in radical politics at the beginning of the 20th century. She was a member of the Socialist Party. She was a member of the IWW for a while, spoke for them. She supported striking workers. She was very concerned about economic inequalities in the United States. She was a suffragist. She was a founding member of the ACLU. You know, but the two women, my read of Ann Sullivan Macy is that in many ways she supported Keller's ideology, but she was highly skeptical of any political involvement. She really had disdain for that. You know, and today it is interesting to me how we remember Helen Keller, and we tend to have glossed over her political life in favor of a sort of bland niceness, which I think would have annoyed Helen Keller tremendously. You know, but the state of Alabama has put her her childhood figure on their state quarter, and apparently I have not seen it, but have just unveiled a new statue of her near the state house in Alabama.
Oh, I did not know that. Well, as her life went on, the roles to some extent became reversed.
They did. You know, I don't know how many of your listeners have had really dear friends that they've maintained over 50-year time period, but you know, the two women were friends for over 50 years, and over those 50 years, their roles in many ways did reverse. You know, during Ann Sullivan Macy's life, she started out as Helen Keller's teacher, but in the later life, Keller was Macy's aide in many respects. She took care of Ann Sullivan Macy. And that could include household tasks, emotional caretaking. I found some wonderful letters. You know, historians, I think, in some ways, were professional gossips. But I found wonderful letters that Ann Sullivan Macy had written. But I think we have to question what written mean, because these were letters that Annie had dictated to Helen Keller. Mm-hmm. Well, Annie was bedridden. And Macy had dictated letters to Helen Keller that Helen Keller typed to friends of theirs. And so the letters start in Ann Sullivan Macy's words. And then two or three times throughout the letters, there are parenthetical comments by Helen Keller within the letters where Ann would be, you know, making her comments about the day or what was going on. And then if Helen Keller disagreed or didn't like it or wanted to whine about what Annie was doing, she would insert a parenthesis and put her own little comment, end of parentheses, and then the letter would go back to Ann Sullivan Macy's prose. You know, but that's simply one of the ways that she served as Keller's aide throughout. It seems to me like the last several decades of Macy's life.
Yeah. Well, Annie's marriage, can you talk a little bit about that marriage?
Sure. Yeah, you know, many people today don't even realize that Ann Sullivan became Ann Sullivan Macy and was married. When Helen Keller was a student at Radcliffe, the female counterpart to Harvard at that time, they had met a young Harvard lecturer named John Macy. He was a writer, a literary critic, and a poet who helped to edit Helen Keller's The Story of My Life, the first book that she wrote. And during that time, he also courted Ann Sullivan. And they became married after Helen Keller's graduation from Radcliffe. He was approximately 11 years younger than Ann Sullivan Macy. He was a socialist himself and a labor activist as well as a writer. And the marriage was pretty tumultuous, really, really tumultuous. You know, they separated in the early 1910s. They took about 10 years to really bring the separation to fruition. They went back and forth. And she refused to divorce him for the rest of her life. He asked to divorce her. She did not want to do so and refused to do so. But they then remained separated the rest of her life. He did meet and spent the rest of his life with another woman. But it was a very tumultuous relationship.
You wonder why they got married in the first place.
You do. You know, they shared a few, it seems like, very sweet love letters, and he wrote her poetry. And she, I suspect, wrote him poetry, because we know that she did write poetry. But it was a very difficult relationship, very thorny relationship. I think it would have been difficult to... they started marriage as the three of them.
Yeah.
The three lived together in a house that largely was owned by Keller. Keller was the primary breadwinner throughout the relationship. You know, Macy was a writer, but you know, writers are not making it rich either now or then. And yeah, it was a pretty dicey relationship. And that what's fascinating to me too is that Helen felt quite it was quite acceptable for her. She felt it was her right to intervene in the relationship. So she wrote letters to Macy, John Macy, scolding him when she didn't like what he did. Her mother stepped in as de facto mother-in-law. It, you know, he sent letters to them as well. John Macy was scolded on several fronts. Apparently, he did drink some, like her father. When that started is not clear. But what's fascinating to me is that when he did die, Anne Sullivan Macy paid for his burial and funeral. Yeah. She continued to write about, refer to him very privately the rest of her life.
Yeah. So as we finish here with our conversation, we have only a minute or two left. What is your enduring memory or your take on Anne Sullivan Macy?
Oh, you know, I've enjoyed her because I think she. A few things. She really lived out friendship, which I think is an important thing that we all need to learn from. She loved literature. She understood the importance of stories as people imagine themselves and imagine creating themselves. She was someone who was really ornery, unreasonable. She could be very passionate about life, stubborn, and yet she knew her own faults and was pretty honest to herself about them throughout her whole life. She's also fascinating to me, you know, a smart, ambitious woman at the very beginning of the 20th century who tried to form meaningful relationships and came from a very poverty-filled background, but became very successful.
Yeah, an amazing person. And in your book, it was great to learn a little bit more about 19th century immigrant life, about the post-Civil War times, the regional differences in them that you that come out as part of your book.
Yeah, I think she in many ways exemplifies U.S. history. She's, you know, the female version of the self-made man.
Yes.
And as you say, her life is one of immigrant life, the development of the U.S. social welfare system, of what it meant to make a marriage as a smart professional woman at that point in time. It's in some ways, it's a very modern story, however.
Yeah. It is that. And Kim, thank you so much for writing the book first, because I enjoyed it very much, and for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, and if I can make one plug for the Wisconsin
Sure.
Book Festival.
Right ahead.
I'm bringing Beyond the Miracle Worker and myself to the Wisconsin Book Festival on Sunday, October 11th, and it looks like they have a great lineup of authors, and I encourage people to check it out.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you very much. Kim Nielsen, award-winning historian, University of Wisconsin Green Bay professor of history, and author of Beyond the Miracle Worker, The Remarkable Life of Anne Sullivan Macy and Her Extraordinary Friendship with Helen Keller. It's a fascinating, fascinating person, Anne Sullivan, and a fascinating book as well. And pleased to have Kim with us today. And also, I'm pleased to have our weather guys come back. They'll be up next, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, joining us to talk climate and weather next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.